KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The University of Washington.
Music like this just makes you want to get up and dance. We're going to dance around the radio retrospective. Think about Armis Brooks, that radio show, and what it said about teaching, teachers, and comedy. Eve Arden was a genius, if you ask me. We're also going to talk about the new Seattle City Council requirement on developers, if they're going to build affordable housing in South Lake Union or pay for it. We'll talk to a developer about what impact that decision will have. And we're going to have a conversation with writer Isabel Allende. That's just in a few moments. All coming up on Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. Thanks for being here. We start, however, taking a look at Fisker Automotive and federal support of electric cars. Electric car maker Fisker Automotive is under the microscope this week. The startup recently fired 75% of its workforce, hired bankruptcy advisors. The company had received nearly $200 million in government loans, but missed its first payment this week. And now Congress is asking questions about the propriety, about the effectiveness and the propriety of Department of Energy loans to what some people are calling politically well-connected companies. In a hearing this week that they titled Green Energy Oversight, Examining the Department of Energy's Bad Bet on Fisker Automotive, some Congress members said taxpayers have effectively subsidized luxury novelty vehicles for the likes of Justin Bieber, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Al Gore, Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio. So what is happening with the electric car movement? Were these bad loans bad investments in an industry and a technology that's not yet ready for prime time? Jeff Allen is executive director of Drive Oregon. The company is involved in trying to get more electric cars on the road. Jeff Allen, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, you must have tracked the Congressional Committee, Green Energy Oversight, examining the Department of Energy's bad bet on Fisker Automotive. They kind of telegraph what they think about the energy loans to Fisker. What's your assessment of those loans?
Well, I feel bad for the workers there at Fisker who've been laid off, but it's as it sounds like, it's clearly a political theater that's going on back there and doesn't really have anything to do with the industry or the success story that is electric vehicles. I think it's important just to back up for a minute to say these loans were made under 2007 legislation and a program that was created by then-President Bush. It was bipartisan at the time, and any time that you're making loans to support companies or investments in companies, you're going to have some that are really successful and some that aren't. And obviously, Fisker was one that has failed. But at the same time, Tesla Motors down in California is paying off their loan twice as fast as they were required to. And it's a shame they're not having a hearing about that success story as well.
Well, let me take one more moment to just split these two apart, and then I want to focus on what's happening with electric vehicles. The argument about Fisker was that maybe they were too politically well-connected but not really ready to actually produce the cars they were promising to produce. So, I mean, the implication is a bit of a scheme. What do you know about Fisker itself?
Well, I don't know a lot more than anybody else can read online. There's no question that they were prepared to make the cars. They did make the cars and sell the cars. There's just not enough people willing to buy them at the price they were selling them at. You know, again, this program also made much larger loans to Nissan, which is now producing the all-electric Nissan Leaf in Tennessee, which is doing really well. They gave nearly $6 billion in loans to Ford, which is obviously still around. So, you know, some were successful and some were not so successful, but I know they put those companies through quite a bit of due diligence before they agreed to make the loans.
So here's the bottom line question to start with. Can electric cars make it without these subsidies from the government today?
Well, electric cars are making it. Again, I think it's an unsold success story. If you went back and looked at when the Prius hybrid was first introduced And the way it's sold, electric cars are actually doing better than the hybrids did in the first couple of years, which is pretty remarkable when you think about, you know, it is a bit difficult or a bit different, rather, to get used to having to plug your car in and instead of going to the gas station and so forth. It's a bigger change. But they've been more successful than the hybrids. In fact, in Portland last month, the Leaf was Nissan's best-selling model. So overall, electric cars are really catching on quite well.
How do you, so in Drive Oregon, advancing the electric vehicle industry, again, are people buying these cars because they're getting a little bit of a subsidy, or as those subsidies disappear, will the price come down to be competitive with, you know, fuel vehicles, gas vehicles?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I would say both, that there is right now $7,500 per vehicle federal tax credit for these cars, and that certainly helps. Anytime you have a new product, you know, the first few are going to be more expensive. You're already seeing the prices on the cars come down pretty dramatically. I think the price reduction on the Leaf this last model year was almost 30% drop in price. So that's happening, partially because the largest cost, upfront cost difference for the car is the battery, and the battery prices have been dropping 20 or 30% a year. The other thing you have to remember is the cost to operate these cars is so much lower. The average driver saves about $1,200 a year switching to an electric car. So the upfront cost is a bit higher, but they pay for themselves over time, especially if you drive a lot of miles.
How is the battery overall, the battery technology and battery industry doing overall? One of the things Fisker ran into was trouble with the 123 company. How are batteries doing overall?
Yeah, overall they're doing pretty well. Actually, the company that's providing the battery for some of the other vehicles like the Volt and the Chevy Spark, those batteries are now being made in the U.S. back east. And again, it's a new technology. You had some companies that that didn't do so well, like A123, and then you've got others that have been more successful, and that'll shake out and settle down here as the market takes off.
One of the things that you're doing with Drive Oregon, Jeff Allen, you're working with the governor. You just signed an agreement last month to expand the number of plug-in electric vehicles and places for getting those plugged in. Where are you at in creating a system where people can plug in their cars?
Yeah, that's right. We are actually primarily an economic development organization, so we're funded by the state of Oregon to grow this industry in the state, which already is a $260 million a year industry in Oregon in the electric vehicle supply chain. But one of the things we realized is that part of what we're selling companies on is that, you know, you want to build your company here because we're a great market for the vehicles as well. So we've stepped into that role. Portland already has more public chargers per capita than any other city in the U.S., and more of the fast chargers, which will charge your car up from empty to full in about 20 or 30 minutes. So we've got a pretty robust network down I-5, all the way from the Canadian border pretty much to the California border, every 25 to 50 miles. And now it's a question of building out some loops on the most popular routes. So if you want to go over to the coast or you want to go over to the mountains, you can do that pretty easily. And then it's also a matter of getting more employers to provide charging for their employees. So if you have a long commute to work and you need to run some errands on the way home, you don't have to worry about having a full charge for that.
How expensive are charging stations?
Not very expensive. And again, that's coming down quite a bit. So there's three levels, right? Level one is just like plugging into a regular wall socket, and that obviously doesn't cost you anything. Level two is more like a dryer socket, and those chargers you can get for around $1,000, $1,200. Can cost more to install them depending on what kind of wiring you have in your house, and it's higher if it's a public charger. You know, it's got to be able to withstand vandalism and that kind of thing. And then the fast chargers are more expensive. Those can be up to gosh, I've seen estimates up to $50,000-$100,000 for those, because again, they're typically public, and you've got some high voltage running through those, so you've got to have them be very sturdy.
How are you paying for them?
So far, most of the chargers, the public chargers, have been paid for with grant funds and federal funds, transportation dollars and other sources like that. You're now seeing most of the household charger, a lot of the household chargers being paid for out of pocket. There are some state and federal tax credits that will offset a lot of that cost. But increasingly, you're seeing the private businesses and homeowners stepping in to put in the chargers. A lot of businesses are seeing that as a great attraction, kind of like free Wi-Fi. If you put in a charger, people are going to hang around your business for a while, spend some money.
So that takes me back to my question. I mean, how long do you think before this industry is able to operate without the tax credits, without the car rebate, and without the grants for the charging infrastructure?
Well, of course, the first question I have to ask is how long until the oil and gas industry is going to operate without subsidies? so I think our
answer to that is
happy to give up the subsidies as soon as they do. But more seriously, I think the car subsidy is set to phase out over the next. It's based on number of vehicles sold, but probably over the next decade or so, that subsidy will phase out. I think the subsidies for chargers, we'll probably be ready to move off of those as well over the next 5 to 10 years.
What subsidies are you speaking of when you talk about the oil and gas industry? Which are the ones that you look at that are comparable and extend?
Well, that's probably a whole other conversation, particularly if you want to get into, how much we're spending to protect oil supplies in hostile parts of the world. But I think just back to basics, there's no infrastructure in the country that's been built without government involvement. If we didn't have government involvement, we wouldn't have the highway system, we wouldn't have road system, we wouldn't have electricity running to our rural communities, we wouldn't have water supplies. So, there's an appropriate role for government in helping to build out this infrastructure.
As you build these fast chargers, and chargers, public chargers around the city are being built, are you running into a bottleneck? Are there more cars than the ability to charge them?
No. In fact, what we're finding is, for most people, 70 or 80% of the charging that's done right now is done at home. And for most people, most people don't drive more than, I think the average is about 25 miles a day, and it's lower in some places like Portland and Seattle and San Francisco. So for most people, these cars will go 70, 80 miles easily on a charge. That's plenty to get you to work, to get you through your errands for the day and get you back home. Psychologically, people want to know, hey, if I decide to drive over to the coast or if I decide to take a longer trip, am I going to be able to do that? So psychologically, it's really important for folks to see those chargers and to know they have that option. But the truth is, people don't wind up using them very much.
So, and finally, Jeff Allen, you mentioned trying to grow Oregon's electric vehicle industry. You have a small grant to a Eugene-based company, Arcimoto. They're going to build some three-wheeled electric vehicles. You have money going to CARES Tech Vehicle Systems to build their motor system for an all-terrain vehicle. What are the other industries that you're seeding?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we mostly have in the Northwest, we're obviously not Detroit, and we're not trying to be Detroit. But what we have in the Northwest is a lot of history in transportation machinery, and it kind of falls on both sides of cars. So we have electric-assist bicycles. We have motorcycle companies like Brammo Motorcycles in Southern Oregon. We have those three-wheeled vehicles and things of that nature. And we have heavy equipment. One of our board members is the only U.S. streetcar manufacturer. We have trucking companies like PACCAR and Daimler Trucks. We have people who make forklifts and airport tugs and those kinds of things. And then the other thing we have is the supply chain. So we know a little bit about software. And the Chevy Volt actually has more lines of computer software in it than a 787 Dreamliner. So These vehicles are very sophisticated. They're much more like computers on wheels, and we know how to do computers. So we're working with a number of companies who do wiring harnesses, software, batteries, charging equipment, motor control systems, things of that nature as well.
What do you drive?
I ride a bicycle.
Is it not even,
ironically enough,
not even an electric assist bicycle?
Not even. As my wife says, any hill I need electric assist for is just a hill I need to ride more often.
Oh, that's nice. All right, Jeff Allen, I appreciate you talking to us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Jeff Allen is Executive Director of Drive Oregon. By the way, they have a call for proposals, $1.7 million in funding available. You have to apply by May 3rd. Energy incentive programs, transportation projects as well. This is Weekday.
It's 9:20. A conversation with author Isabel Allende in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Blue Homes, a builder of modern-designed, precision-built homes, who is hosting a tour of a glide house on Vashon Island on April 27th and 28th from noon to 4 p.m. Directions and more at bluhomes.com/Vashon.
55 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 69 this afternoon with lots of sun. Tomorrow, some clouds in the morning, then sunny again with a high of 65.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
President Obama's sister, Maya Satoru Ng, is an author and a former history teacher. We're going to get her thoughts on how she thinks her brother's presidency will be remembered in about 20 minutes.
Isabel Allende is a world-renowned writer with 20-plus-1 books, 35 languages. Her latest is Maya's Notebook, a tale that revolves around a descent into addiction and a rebirth through the love of family, love of place. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's nice to see you again.
Thanks.
You know, 20-plus books. What keeps you excited about still writing books?
Well, I'm unemployable. What else could I do? I don't see myself doing anything else, really. And I tried to retire like 2 years ago, and my family went crazy. They just can't stand me when I'm not writing.
I just like the idea of writers being unemployable. That's sort of the definition of a writer.
Of course. You end up writing when everything else fails.
But you could do other things. So you are still inspired by the blank sheet in front of you and the ideas inside your head.
I'm tormented by stories that grow inside like tumors, and eventually I have to write them down, exorcise the demons, the obsessions.
Is that really true?
Yes,
they're like demons in your head?
They grow, not in my head, in my belly. They grow and grow and grow, and then they start suffocating me.
Are they stories with characters, with voices, with faces that you imagine?
Sometimes it's an idea, an obsession about something. Sometimes it's a voice of a character that I don't know who the character is until I start writing. And slowly the character emerges from the shadows and becomes a person and tells me the story.
That sounds less like work and more like, passion, poetry, drive.
Drive. I'm telling you, obsession.
Yeah, obsession. Yeah. But not work.
No, it's not work.
It's not
work. The most difficult part of writing is sitting down.
What do you mean, the first time or at all?
No, sitting down. I mean, hours and hours sitting down in front of a computer. My back hurts. My muscles hurt.
Do you write for hours and hours at a time?
I get up very early and I write all day until 7 o'clock in the afternoon. Usually 8 hours, 10 hours a day.
Really? When do you rewrite? Is that part of the process or do you have a separate?
Now it's part of the process because I write directly in a computer. So I'm all the time correcting. Before, it used to be 1,000 drafts.
Wow. Sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
Maybe that's your family just needed you to take more vacations.
No. My family needs me locked away someplace where I don't talk to them.
You said in Maya's Notebook that you were thinking about your family and especially your grandkids, right?
Yeah.
Are they going to read these books? This book?
Probably at some point. It just came out in English, and my grandchildren don't read Spanish, so I hope they will read it. When I wrote the book 2 years ago, all my grandchildren were teenagers. Now they're all in college. Thank God they are safe. But there was a period where the parents and me as a grandmother were horrified at the risks they take, the dangers they're exposed to, things that never happened to my generation or my children's generation.
You really feel that way? That your children, for example, your children's generation, what would that be, 80s, 70s, 80s?
My son was born in 1966.
Yeah. That it was just a safer world?
A safer world.
In California?
No, I was living in Venezuela, which was not very safe. But there was no internet, so they were not exposed to so much stuff like porn and violence. And the world was more contained. The family was more important. It was a safer place. Now I think that the world that my grandchildren live in is much more interesting. And if I had to choose, I would rather live in that world.
Though it's more dangerous.
Although it's more dangerous.
Maya, she's ensconced in her family in this book, Maya's Notebook. She's got loving people around her.
But she falls through the cracks when the family falls apart. When her beloved grandfather dies, she has been raised by the grandparents, and the grandmother goes into a depression. Then this kid who was athletic, had good grades, a normal kid.
16 years old,
just goes wild.
And that's the, isn't that normal for kids to go wild?
I think it's normal. For example, in my family, I saw several of them, two or three, go wild. But the parents were there, containing them somehow. My son lost all his hair with his youngest daughter because she was 15 and she had the boyfriend from hell. And she looked like Jennifer Lopez at 15 and had the brain of an 8-year-old. So can you imagine for a father what that is? It's horrible. So I saw my son suffering, and he could protect her because he was on top of it. He installed a GPS in her phone, so he would always know where she was.
But why not? Why do you not think that the kind of trust that you must have had from your parents and that he got from you would not be adequate?
Sometimes it is adequate, but sometimes it's not. At the time, we had 6 teenagers in the family. 2 of them were wild, and the other one were manageable, and they had a life. But sometimes, you know, it's character also.
Yeah, it is character. So in thinking about your grandkids, how do you talk to them about the sort of ideas that are in this book? Exposure to pornography, exposure to violence, exposure to drugs.
We talk about everything. We talk about money, sex, relationships, everything. I'm very, very open with them. I tell them about my life, my problems. The idea that grandmother can have sex is something that horrifies them. They don't want to hear about it. But I talk about everything so that they can talk to me also. Yeah, and I think parents do pretty much the same.
As you mentioned, they could find all that on the internet. So they're exposed to ideas in a way that we weren't exposed to. Maybe they could find more more fluidity in their understanding because of that.
Yeah. But this is a book also about coming out of that stage of redemption. Maya, although she goes into hell, she ends up in Las Vegas, homeless, sick, addicted, persecuted by the police, the FBI, the CIA, the criminals, the gangsters, the drug dealers, everybody. She's there only for a few months, and she's rescued right in time. And her grandmother sends her to the southern part of Chile, where she can be cut away from this permanent noise in which we live, this super connection to everything. Our lifeline is the phone. We can't live without it.
Your vehicle for Maya is a blank notebook on an island where there's, like you say, no connection, no technology to interfere.
There is technology, but she can't use it.
Right, yeah. Do we need all that? Do you think that your grandkids would need that at some point?
I think that my grandkids and every kid would benefit from some time for reflection, some silence. I think that it is in silence, being bored, that you become creative. We live in a world where you can't be bored for a minute. You have to be entertained. Even Even homework has to be entertaining. Everything needs to be entertaining. And the capacity for attention becomes shorter and shorter. And the stimuli has to be increased permanently. So now violence has to be extreme violence, and I don't know what they're going to come up with to make it even worse so that people will be interested. Nothing is enough.
Do you ever face the piece of paper and a pen? Is that how? Do you ever write like that, the way Maya writes?
Not anymore. Because I have an iPad, so I travel with my iPad, and I take notes in little pieces of paper, but only sentences. I don't write on paper. My husband, who is a writer also, writes on paper, on legal pads, by hand. I don't know how he does it.
But I mean, for Maya, that there's catharsis in that. There's learning in that in this book.
Yeah.
So but you don't. You're an older person. You don't need that. You don't need that moment of quiet reflection that a piece
but
of paper
still,
and a pen gives you.
I spend most of my life alone in silence, doing exactly that, writing maybe not in a piece of paper but on a screen.
And
why? What do I write? I write about the things that connect to my own experience, to my memory, to the things that I'm passionate about. I can't write a wonderful story that you give me if I'm not connected to the story. So every story is an exploration of myself, of my life, of the way I see the world. That's what's lacking in Maya's life.
Yeah. I just was wondering if the media, the blank screen is the same for you as the blank piece of paper for...
Yeah, it is, but it's better. Because in a blank screen, I can correct indefinitely. In a piece of paper, once you've written it, it's done. You have to write again the whole paragraph if you need to correct something.
Yeah, no, I get that as a working person. Mm. I'm just
you
wondering,
do,
as,
yeah.
But I wonder as a tool by which we come to reflection on our lives. I mean, you sent this character for a reason to a quiet place, to reassess her life, and you had her in front of a piece of paper. Because like you say, there is technology on this island, but that's not the tool that you thought would help her.
Because this is a girl who needs to calm down.
Calm down?
Calm down. I mean, she lives, first of all, addicted. Drugs, speed, all kinds of stuff. And noise in her head. And she's all the time doing something. She cannot be calm for a minute. There's a moment in the book when she says, I look back and I don't remember why I was in such a hurry. Why was I running around like crazy? She can't remember why. She had that thing that was, she was always short of breath.
Isabel Allende's latest novel is Maya's Notebook. You know, the writing about this from your publisher and from reviewers is a bold departure because you're writing in contemporary times. Do you see it that way?
Yeah. I had been writing historical novels for a long time, and I got fed up with the research. So I needed something that I thought was going to be lighthearted. It isn't very lighthearted, but for me, writing it was easy, really easy. It was just a matter of looking around, hearing the voices of my grandchildren, picking up the stories. Very easy.
What kind of research did you do about child sex? Child prostitution, sex rings, drugs, all in this not lighthearted part of the book.
Well, I did some research on that, but that's available everywhere.
On that tool, on that iPad you were talking about.
Of course. And unfortunately also, in my husband's family, we have three addicted children who are now adults. Two of them have already died of drug-related causes. The youngest died 4 weeks ago. So the family is really mourning at this point. And I have seen the devastation of that kind of life, not only for the people who are involved, but for everybody around them, friends, family. And you can't help them. It's a tragedy to see how they descend in this spiral into hell, and there's no way that you can stop them.
Boy, you think you're writing fiction, but you're not always, I mean, it is fiction, but it's all wrapped around what's happening.
Why do I choose to write about that? Because I've lived it. Because it has been so, I mean, such a horrible burden in my marriage also. In our lives, Willie and I, we carry this heaviness, you know. So, of course I write about it, because in a way, that's my way of exercising the pain.
I think that's funny that you said you were thinking about writing something lighthearted.
Yeah. Well, it is lighthearted because there's redemption, there's love, there's humor. The girl, the way she sees the world, in my opinion, is very humorous.
Yeah, it is very humorous, isn't it? One question before I let you go on a topic. The island that she goes to?
Chiloé. It exists.
Have you been there?
Yeah. Chiloé is an archipelago of several islands, more than 100 islands. And for a long time, it was very disconnected from the continent in the southern part of Chile. So it has a very peculiar and unique culture and mythology that was not influenced by the Catholic Church, the mythology. So it's very interesting and it's been studied now for a long time.
You have an anthropologist there studying?
Yes,
it in the
yes. Park? And I have been there because I have friends who live there. But I went in a special trip with a very knowledgeable guide that took me around and we chose the perfect island.
Isabel Allende's book is Maya's Notebook. It's already an international bestseller in other languages, now out in English. It's good to see you again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
This is Weekday.
In a minute here, we're going to talk with President Obama's sister about her brother's presidency and ultimate legacy. That's right around the corner.
Support for KUOW comes from the Gardner Center for Asian Art and Ideas, presenting two lectures on Japanese art by Yoshiaki Shimizu from Princeton University on Thursday, April 25th and Sunday, April 28th at the Seattle Asian Art Museum. More information at seattleartmuseum.org/Gardner Center.
56 degrees in Seattle under a blue sky with lots of sun. Forecast says mostly sunny all day with an afternoon high of 69. We're looking at some clouds overnight with a low of 47, few clouds in the morning tomorrow, but then sunny again tomorrow afternoon with a high of 65.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, offering physicians a dinner seminar on how to best manage the challenges of health care payment reform, Tuesday, April 30th at Red Lion Hotel, Olympia. Details at athenahealth.com/WANPR.
9:37. KUOW's Marcy Silman talks with Seattle Theater's power couple, Bob Wright and Katie Forget, in 10 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell on Mercer Island, speaking with Maya Satoru-Ing. She's a writer with a PhD in international comparative education. She's taught middle school, high school, and universities, and she's also the half-sister of President Obama. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you, Katie.
Well, you know, you have to ask the first question. What was it like for you the night that Obama was first elected?
It was extraordinary, but it was complicated. Our grandmother, Madeline, who used to live here on Mercer Island, died the night before the election. So I was with her and was busy making burial arrangements and kind of wrapping my spirit around the fact that she was gone at the same time that I was celebrating my brother's victory and thinking about what it all meant on a personal level in terms of how this would alter our family, but also what it meant to the nation and to the world. And so it was very heady. It was very overwhelming. There were lots of tears, but ultimately the feelings were very positive. I feel now, as strongly as I did then, that he is, in fact, the man for our time. That we will be changed in ways that we can't see today, that it will only be in hindsight and in retrospect that we will fully understand his impact.
What did your grandmother feel about him, the possibility that he was going to be the president?
I said to her, you know, as she was dying, and our grandmother was 100% in mind, even though her body was broken. I told her, you know, your grandson is probably going to be president. And she said, I know. And I detected, of course, a tinge of wariness. And I think that she was probably worried about the burden that he would have to carry. And when asked what my mom would have felt about his becoming president, the answer would be the same. A mix of pride and jubilation and worry. She believed in him and loved him so much. She was tired, body broken. But I sort of feel, as corny as this sounds, as though by her passing away the night before, she was allowing her spirit to be where her body could not be, by his side. And it was a way to get her to travel to go and see him and support him.
Was it different when he got reelected?
The second time was different. This time I was less worried. 4 years ago I worried about his well-being, whether or not he would be beloved, you know. And the truth is that many of the things I worry about have come to pass, namely that there are detractors and the spotlight has been intense, and I'm sure he's aged more than he would have had he not been there, but everyone's okay. Not everyone loves him, but many do, and many are grateful. So this time I could sort of enjoy the process more, knowing that we can disentangle the private man from the public and rely on him to be present with us at Christmas most of the time. Family rituals is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to think that he plays too much Scrabble. I said coming here that we play every day. That is true, but it's just a turn or two, taking a couple of minutes, not a whole game. But we do touch bases in those ways. All of that is also good for him.
I'm speaking with Maya Sotoro-Ing, who's the half-sister of President Obama. Now, the two of you grew up in a multiracial family. How do you think that informs you both going forward?
Our family was, in fact, complex after Mom's marriages. And my father was Indonesian, and Barack lived in Indonesia for 4 years of childhood. We lived in Hawaii, of course, and grew up in a place that is extremely diverse ethnically and culturally. And I think for us what that meant was that we kind of had to always be alert to other ways of thinking and being. We had to have a nuanced understanding of multiple cultures. We had to be sensitive and patient on some level to learn to listen for cultural cues so as not to offend. I think that he definitely felt a desire as a result of our undulating childhood to settle down. And in the choice of Michelle, we see someone very solid. I think that perhaps he wanted to move less, but he was given the gifts of movement by our mother, and that serves him well. I married a Canadian whose parents are Chinese, born in Malaysia, and continue to live in Hawaii because for me there was great adventure and delight in that movement.
Speaking with Maya Sotoro-Ing, she's a writer and she has a PhD in international comparative education. She's also taught in middle school, high school, and universities. And I wanted to ask you, since I read that you were a history teacher at least part of that time, if you were teaching the class on American presidents 50 years from today, do you have a sense of what his storyline is going to be?
Well, I think that's a really fascinating question. I think it's going to be positive. I think this time has been one where we've seen a lot of contention and there has been some division. But I also think that that kind of struggle and turmoil is needed. It's part of the growing pains of becoming more extraordinary as a nation. And this is a time, quite simply, when there are lots of undulations in the world, lots of changes. My feeling is that there's no one else who better represents that, and that is a positive thing. There are going to be changes in human civil rights, changes in the way government takes place. I think there are going to be changes in healthcare and the kind of service that is expected of our leaders, and much more. I won't go on, but I do think that in the end, we're going to see this time as an important, pivotal time at the crossroads. And I believe that's how his legacy will read.
What do you think your influence on him has been?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think that I've had too much influence on him, except I resemble our mother in many ways. So she's the woman to whom the credit should be given for his commitment to education and his communication and storytelling. We call it talk story in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I think all of her gifts are firmly embedded in him, and as the younger sister, learned from both of them.
Are you looking forward to 2016 when he's no longer in office?
I will worry more about the state of the nation. I hope that someday before too long, my brother will be able to take a walk, a long walk, be able to take deep breaths and to see far and not have too much on his tail. I'd like that for him, because that was always his way to reflect and find peace before. The path around the White House is pretty short.
Mm-hmm. Maya Satoru Ng, she's a writer with a PhD in international comparative education. She's also the half-sister of President Obama and the author of a children's book called Letter to the Moon, inspired by her mother. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun, and it's wonderful to meet you.
Now we turn to another segment of The Art of Our City. Seattle theater audiences know R. Hamilton Bob Wright for his long career on stage. Wright and his wife, the former actor Katie Forgette, have created parallel careers on the other side of the footlight, too. Forgette's a produced playwright. Wright's a writer and a stage director, as well as an actor. ACT Theater is raising the curtain on their first major stage collaboration. It's going on this weekend. Forgette's new play, Assisted Living, is directed by Wright, features an all-star cast of veteran Seattle actors, including ACT's artistic director, Kurt Beattie, his wife, Marion Owen, on stage together for the first time in more than a decade. So Marcy Silman was thinking about all this history. She met with Wright and Forgette during a break in rehearsals.
It's set in the future. Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security have all gone away. And Dick Cheney is our new president. And now when you get sick and are over 65, you go to an assisted living facility, which is a converted federal penitentiary. And that's where you go, and the government takes care of you.
Topical. It's not sci-fi exactly.
No, not sci-fi. No. I mean, I imagine something like this could happen. I really, really hope that it won't happen. But a version of this, I think, is possible.
It's kind of billed as a comedy, is it?
Yes, but black comedy. Cuckoo's Nest meets Golden Girls a little bit.
Is that how you pitched it to ACT?
No, I didn't. I just recently came up with that.
How long have you been writing this?
I think I came up with the first draft about 2 years ago, and then I sat on it for a little while. And then Kurt kept asking to read it, and I kept not giving it to him. And then, because I just thought it wouldn't be his cup of tea. And then I finally gave it to him, and he liked it.
Now, Bob Wright, it's not nepotism, is it, that you're directing your wife's play?
It probably is, actually. I don't know. Kurt asked me to direct it. It wasn't. I wanted to make it very clear it wasn't a package deal, because I love the play and it deserves to be produced. And I was very pleased when he asked me, and kind of surprised, frankly.
Why were you surprised?
I'm frankly not a super experienced director. I mean, I've done a bit of it. I mean, you know, over the last, I'm 60 now, and over the last 10 years, I've directed a number of times. Mm-hmm. But You know, I have a tendency to think that there's a lot of people out there who are a lot more talented than I am as a director. And so, but I, at least now I feel I've gotten to this this age that I have some things that I can be useful. I mean, I can be useful for a production or for actors.
Does a playwright have any say in the hiring of the director, Katie?
I think I had veto power. I won't mention any names. If Kurt had mentioned someone who I thought was just wrong, I think he would have listened to me. But he mentioned Bob. And the great thing about having Bob is that he was there at the beginning. I mean, when I had the idea for this play, and then you write a scene and go out into the living room and say, read this. And
you don't perform it for him?
No, I don't. We don't do that anymore. I think we fired each other on our sofa one night. We were reading a play, and anyway, Bob wasn't taking my notes, so I fired him. And then he read the first act when there was just one act. And so he's really been in on the ground floor and understands what the play is about.
Talk a little bit about the cast of this play.
Well, there's a number of people in the play that we've both known for a really long time. I mean, I've known Kurt for going on 40 years, 36, 7 years. And
you wanted to say the cast before we talk about how long you've known him.
Absolutely. Kurt Beatty and Marianne Owen, who also happened to be married, are in the play. Laura Kinney, Julie Briskman, Jeff Stitzer, Tim Gowron. And there's a lot of colleagues here that we've known for a long time. And that isn't always the case. You know, it's always great to work with people you haven't worked with before. But in the case of this, we were looking for people that could legitimately age up. We just have to believe that they're of retirement age, that they're of Medicare age. So 65 is not much of a stretch for those of us who are pushing that. And
on a bad day, they might look, you know, a little older than that.
Is it harder for you to direct people? You mentioned you've known Kurt for over 35 years. Is it hard as peers? I mean, you guys are peers. Hard for them to take you seriously as a director?
I hope not. I don't think so. I think there's, I have two people in this play. Everyone in this play is remarkably gifted. I mean, I can't tell you what it is to sit down and just watch people just fumble through the first day of reading a play on their feet and realize that their instincts are as good, that they're going to come to most of this stuff without any help from me, which is a great relief, really. I mean, it is. I mean, it's not like you have to worry about trying to teach anybody about anything. You're just sort of there to nudge and to encourage and to maybe, provide some angles that maybe they're not thinking about. But I also have Kurt and Jeff both, of course. Jeff Stitzer, who I don't think I mentioned, is in the show. They're both lifelong directors. That's an intriguing dynamic.
You mentioned it's a black comedy, a dark comedy. When you write a comedy and you think it's funny, you read it to your husband who performs comedy, he thinks it's funny, Kurt picks it up, decides it's funny. When you put it in front of a cast, is there any kind of trepidation, like maybe it's not funny?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah, in fact, I mean, just reading it the past couple days, I wanted to cut about 50% of the play. It just sounds, it can sound, because I know it so well and I've read it so often and we've talked about it, at some point, whatever comedy was there wears off a little bit and it just sounds deadly. So you have to kind of, keep going and not make drastic cuts right away, otherwise you won't have a play left at the end of the day.
Are you making cuts as you go right now?
Oh, sure. Making cuts and additions. Yes.
Wow. So it's like a living being.
It is. Yes. Yes. In fact, Julie Briskman just said, can I get a new page 5? Because she's got arrows and going all over the place, things circled, blacked out, put back in, taken out again.
I'm wondering how you approach, forget that it's Katie for a second. You've got something that is really fluid. So how do you approach that?
Well, the great thing is, I think every actor involved in the play, I like working on new plays because I enjoy having people throw stuff at you. I mean, it can be nerve-wracking, but I think when you sign up for a new play, even the great thing is a director, this play is in really good shape. So I don't feel like we're looking at suddenly, and we've all done these kinds of shows where you get a new second act after the third preview because the whole play has been gutted and reworked. I mean, that does happen. But it's really fun to be involved with the play being crafted. And the best thing you can do as actors is simply do what you have on the page as well as you can and allow the writer to hear it And not, you know, I mean, some of us sometimes make suggestions, but the best suggestion you can make as an actor is to simply say the words well.
This second act isn't going to be gutted, is it, Katie?
I'm sorry, gutted? No, it will not be gutted. No, I don't think so.
How is it? I'm actually not remembering the last time I saw you on stage. So how long is it that you've been a writer compared to how long that you were an actor?
I think I started writing plays around the time I was 40, but, you know, not, I think I wrote one play and then...
And now you're 41, so how...
Exactly. I know. God bless you. I love you. I think, but then I didn't write very regularly. I've written more in the past probably 6 years than I have, and I acted up until I was in my early 40s.
So when you watch these people who you know as well as Bob, pretty much, I think, or close to it, watch them perform your words, something that you created, is there a part of you that wishes that you were wearing their hat?
That's a great question. No, there isn't. I haven't even thought that, really. I haven't thought about acting a lot. I was offered The Women, and I didn't do it because I have a day job. So that was the last time I was really tempted to be in a play.
So that's it. And being a writer is satisfying in the same ways, different ways?
Different ways. There's a lot more control. I mean, you don't have to get anyone's permission to write a play. You have to get permission to be in a play.
And more than permission.
More than permission, yeah. And you get to make a lot of decisions on your own. You have all the power until you turn it over to someone else. And I like that a lot.
Bob, is that why you have been doing more directing? Because you're still in so many things.
Yeah, I mean, some of it, you know, the idea when I started looking for more directing work, some of it was that I'd hit 50 and I could see the writing on the wall that even as a successful, you know, I've had a lot of work. I have nothing to complain about, but you just don't have there's not as many roles out there because even for a man, it's much easier than for a woman. A woman hits 35 and you feel like, Jesus, it's just, it's dried up. But I wanted to sort of expand the possibility of working in the theater, and then I did think that at about 50 that maybe I had some things that would be helpful. As a director, though, what I realize as a director that what fascinates me most about it is watching actors. I don't really relish the idea of having a tremendous amount of influence. In fact, as I direct more, I find that the thing I like to experiment with in my mind is how much influence can I give up in the process.
Doesn't that depend on the cast?
Totally, yeah. If you're lucky enough to have a really deeply talented and a skilled group of people who are self-starters and smart, then it's all about seeing how often you can bite your tongue and not speak.
Yeah. So you've just named a cast, all of whom have been working in Seattle for a long time. Two of them, as you mentioned, are directors. Julie Brisman just finished sort of producing, this years-long Seagull project. So people who are thinking at a meta level, can you at some point do you anticipate during this process that you're just going to sit back and enjoy yourself?
Yeah, it's already started.
I mean, if you cast it well, you've done so much of your work already. And if you don't cast it well, you will never be able to do enough to save it.
The idea then for you as a playwright is that this opens to great success and then it goes someplace, right? Is that how it works?
That is exactly how it works, Marcy.
That's not how it works.
I hope so. From your lips to God's ears. I mean, please, that'd be great. I'll take it.
That's Marcy Silman talking to Bob Wright and his wife and partner in their work on their new play, which is opened up at ACT and is on stage again this weekend. Katie Forgette and Bob Wright opening up sort of the discussion about what did Marcy call them? All the alter cockers that are now working hard in theater.
And now, the sound of the day.
Wow. That's the sound listener Keith hears at night. Wow. His son Ruben has a pet hedgehog, Jamocha, who's nocturnal. He's most active after midnight, and this was Jamocha on his exercise wheel. Keith recorded this noise while standing in the hallway outside the room Jamocha was in. His son is a sound
sleeper.
Plenty
of time to record that because you're not sleeping.
His son is a sound sleeper, though. I hope that they oiled that wheel afterwards.
That hedgehog better be darn cute. That's all I know.
Oh, man. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Record 30 seconds. Send it to us. The sound of your day, or in this case, the sound of the middle of your night. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. More weekday coming up. Stay with us.
Boy, that's annoying enough to listen to during the day.
We should just run that for listeners. They would really appreciate that.
It's 9:59. Seattle City Council says it expects developers to include some affordable housing in new residential towers in the South Lake Union neighborhood, or else. Or else what? We'll find out and we'll examine the options developers are looking at just a couple minutes from now, right after the news. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield, connecting members to people and resources that matter to.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.